19. Fish. Brown took Milgram back to the Korean-owned laundry on Lafayette Street for parking. From what Milgram had heard of Brown's end of the morning's cellular traffic, Brown felt that his team needed more talking to about having lost the IF. This time, Brown didn't bother to remind Milgram that there were watchers outside, or that attempting to escape would be both futile and painful. Brown was starting to assume, Milgram decided, that he, Milgram, had internalized the watchers, whether they existed or not, and Milgram now doubted they ever had. This was interesting, Milgram thought. Brown didn't say goodbye, just turned and headed down the west side of Lafayette. Milgram and the Korean owner, a man in his 70s, with an ageless and curiously non-reflective simulacrum of Kim Jong-il's jet-black haircut, eyed each other neutrally. Milgram supposed Brown had some arrangement here, as the Korean never asked where Milgram's laundry was, or why it was, otherwise, that Milgram would sit for hours at the westernmost end of a red vinyl settee, either reading his medieval messianism book, thumbing through the Korean's dead gossip magazines, or just staring into space. Milgram unbuttoned the Paul Stewart, but seated himself without removing it. He looked at the thick compost of celebrity features on the coffee table in front of him. Did navels count as features? And noted the issue of time, with the president dressed up like a pilot on the flight deck of that aircraft carrier. That issue was nearly 3 years old now, he decided, after some calculation. Older than the majority of these gossip mags, which Milgram did sometimes resort to, if 12th-century messianism proved inconveniently soporific, as it certainly could. If he nodded out here, he'd learned, the Korean would come over and prod him in the ribs with a rolled-up us. At the moment, however, he was ready for William the Goldsmith and the Amorian spirituals, who were the run-up, so to speak, to his favorite, the heresy of the free spirit. He was sliding his hand into his pocket to retrieve the comfortingly worn volume when a dark-haired girl in high brown boots and a short white jacket entered. He watched a transaction take place, the Korean giving her a receipt in exchange for two pairs of dark pants. Then, rather than leaving, she took out a phone, started carrying on a conversation in animated Spanish, crossed to the settee, and sat while talking, raking periodically and without much interest through the gossip magazines on the Korean's plywood coffee table. President Bush in his flight suit went under almost immediately, but she didn't manage to turn up anything Milgram hadn't seen before. Still, it was pleasant to share this vinyl bench with her and to enjoy the sound of a language he didn't understand. His seemingly innate fluency in Russian, he'd always assumed, had somehow been paid for with the loss of any ability in the Romance languages. The girl dropped her phone back into her large purse, stood, smiled absently in his general direction, and walked out. He was pulling his book from his pocket when he saw her phone lying there on the red vinyl. He looked over at the Korean, who was reading the Wall Street Journal. Those weird little stipple portraits at this distance reminded Milgram of fingerprints. He looked back at the phone. His captivity had changed him. Prior to Brown, he would have pocketed the phone automatically. Now that he lived in the woodwork of Brown's world of surveillance, seemingly random encounters had become suspect. Had that been a real Spanish-speaking beauty, dropping off her office trousers for cleaning? Or was she part of Brown's team? Was it really an accident that she'd left her phone? But what if it wasn't? With an eye on the Korean, he palmed the phone. It was still warm, a small but vaguely shocking intimacy. He stood. I need to use the bathroom. The Korean looked at him over his Wall Street Journal. I need to pee. Folding his paper, the Korean stood, held aside a curtain made of flowered fabric, and gestured Milgram through. Milgram walked quickly past a clutter of industrial ironing equipment and through a narrow beige-painted door with a silk-screened employees-only sign. The walls of the cubicle inside were white-painted plywood, reminding Milgram of the cabins at a summer camp he'd attended in Wisconsin. It smelled powerfully but not unpleasantly of disinfectant. On general principle, Milgram secured the door with a fragile-looking piece of gold-toned Taiwanese hardware. He put the lid down on the toilet, seated himself, and had a look at the girl's phone. It was a Motorola, with call display and camera. A model from a few years before, though as far as he knew they were still selling them. If he'd stolen it for resale, he would have been disappointed. As it was, it had an almost full battery charge and was roaming. He looked up at a 1992 calendar, level with his eyes and about 10 inches away. Someone had quit pulling the months off in August. It advertised a commercial real estate firm and was decorated with the drastically color-saturated daytime photograph of the New York skyline, complete with the black towers of the World Trade Center. These were so intensely peculiar-looking, in retrospect, so monolithically sci-fi blank, unreal, that they now seemed to Milgram to have been photoshopped into every image he encountered them in. Below the calendar, on a 4-inch-wide ledge formed by a horizontal in the cubicle's framing, stood a bare tin can, its sides lightly freckled with rust. Milgram leaned forward and studied its contents. A thin strata of nuts, bolts, 2 bottle caps, paper clips and thumbtacks, several unidentifiable metal components, corpses of small insects. Everything there that could oxidize was lightly, evenly, rusted. He settled back against the toilet tank and opened the phone. Hispanic full names in the phone book, interspersed with girls' names that mostly weren't. He entered Fish's number from memory, closed his eyes, and thumbed send. Fish, short for Fisher, his surname, answered before a third ring.
Hello.
Fish. Hi.
Who's this?
Milgram. Hey.
Fish sounded surprised to hear from him, but then Milgram supposed he would be. Fish was a fellow benzo user. Aside from that, what they had most in common was Dennis Birdwell, Milgram's dealer. Former dealer, Milgram corrected himself. Both Milgram and Fish were long past doctor shopping, and neither was going to get anywhere with New York's triple-form prescription system. Fish had resources in New Jersey, a writing doctor, Milgram assumed, but they both depended primarily on Birdwell. Or rather, they both had, as Milgram no longer could.
How are you doing, Milgram?
Meaning, do you have any to spare?
Just getting by, Milgram said.
Oh,
Fish said. He was always short. He did something in computer animation and had a girlfriend and a baby.
Have you seen Dennis, Fish?
Yeah, I have.
How is he?
Well, he's angry with you. That's what he said.
Did he say why?
He said he'd given you money for something and it didn't happen.
Milgram sighed.
That's true, but it wasn't me letting him down. The guy I was going through, you know?
A baby began to cry behind Fish's voice.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think you want to mess with Dennis these days. Not that way.
Fish sounded uncomfortable, and not just because of the crying baby.
How do you mean?
Well, said Fish, you know, it's his other stuff.
Dennis's other stuff was crystal meth, increasingly his main stock in trade, and something neither Milgram nor Fish had the least use for. It did, however, create in Dennis's other clients a need for powerfully soothing peripheral substances. Hence Dennis's interest in the benzos they both relied on for peace and clarity.
I think he's dipping, Fish said. You know, more.
Milgram raised his eyebrows to the image of the Twin Towers.
Sorry to hear that.
You know how they get.
How do you mean?
Paranoid, Fish said. Violent.
Dennis had once been a student at NYU. Milgram could certainly imagine him angry,
but imagining him violent was a stretch.
"He collects Star Wars memorabilia," Milgram said. "He sits there all night looking for it on eBay."
There was a pause. Fish's baby fell silent, too, in eerie-seeming synchrony. "He said he'd hire black guys from Brooklyn." The baby began to scream again, even harder.
"Shit," said Milgram, as much to the rusty tin can as to Fish. "Do me a favor?"
"Yeah?"
"Don't tell him you heard from me."
"Easy," said Fish.
"If I get extra," Milgram lied, "I'll call you."
He pressed end. Back out front, he helped the unhappy Puerto Rican girl move the red settee so she could look under it. While she did that, he slid her phone under a hang-nailed copy of In Touch, with Jennifer Aniston on the cover. He was leaning against a dryer, reading about William the Goldsmith, when she found it.